Who is a mature believer? Well, ultimately, bottom line, it's a person that doesn't justify their sinful behavior. They're willing to look at it clearly, they're willing to focus on it, and they're willing to do it over and over again. Ultimately, bottom line, they're willing to look at reality and truth in their lives rather than to create a fantasy that makes them feel better.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Jack, I bet people who have been following our program are going to be pretty amazed that today we are finally not going to be continuing in the Beatitudes.
Yeah.
You know, Jack, sometimes, you know what talking to you is like?
Talking to a wall.
Kind of. I hope people have a little bit of, feel sorry for me a little bit.
Just sometimes you make me speechless.
Oh, gosh. Well, it is kind of funny. You and I have such different personalities. I am just, you know, I can just run at the mouth really easily. And sometimes I look at you and I expect a response and you just kind of look at me. So anyway, we're not going to be doing the Beatitudes today, but we have been doing a series on spirituality. What is spirituality? Biblical spirituality. We got into the Beatitudes and I think it was just a really good series. What we wanted to do today really sprang out of teaching that I heard from you. I was wondering if spirituality, if spiritual man or woman, is synonymous with the mature person.
Yes, and I think the short answer is yes, absolutely. That the notion of maturity in the New Testament has to do with a flourishing spirituality. Maybe we should talk about that word a little bit. The word that's translated mature is teleos in Greek, but it comes from a Greek word telos, which means the kind of purposed, designed end for something. Maybe the best way to understand the term telos is to go into actually Greek philosophy, because telos is a very important term to Aristotle in his philosophy, that he believed that everything in the cosmos had its own unique and special telos. And what he meant by that is it had a rational design that had a rational end to it. So the telos of an acorn was a big oak tree, or the telos of a little baby human being was a full-grown human being, or the telos of, and you can just, as we look at the design in nature, whatever things are designed to become over the course of time as they grow and develop and have their history, they're going to end up in a particular place that's already been kind of defined for them. And that the word he uses for that end place where they are designed to go is their telos. Well, that's the root meaning of the word that's used for maturity, that's translated maturity in our New Testaments. Teleos is to have arrived or neared to one's telos. So the question, though, is, well, what's the process we're talking about that has a telos? And I think you have rightly suggested by your question that the process it's talking about is the process of our sanctification, the process of our becoming spiritual men or women, that there's a purposed end for that, and to the extent that we reach that or near that, we are becoming teleos or mature. We're nearing the end.
So God, in the process of sanctification, is the one who's authoring the telos or the maturity in our lives.
Right.
It's up to him.
Right, exactly. Now, it happens, of course, and he's the author of it, it happens, of course, through that process that we have defined on a number of different occasions in a number of different ways. The struggles, the agony, the tribulations, the trials, the suffering of our lives that forces us to raise very important questions about our existence and our individual relationship to God and resolve those questions. And in resolving those questions, we kind of settle down into a certain wisdom, a certain perspective, a certain way of looking at life that becomes kind of ingrained in our hearts and our minds. And that process whereby a way of looking at life that at first is just intriguing to us, eventually over the course of time, as we mature, that way of looking at life actually becomes the fixed, foundational, permanent attitude that we have toward life or perspective on life. Well, that's more mature. To just be intrigued by it and think that probably it's true and that that's the way I want to go is an aspect of our spirituality, but it's much less mature. Over the course of time, it becomes almost second nature to us to, in a way that I need to qualify, we'll need to talk about that, but in one way of speaking, it becomes kind of second nature to us to look at life that way.
Okay, so what I said was God is the author of our spirituality, of our maturity, and what you came back with in essence was, yes, absolutely he is, and we really see ourselves as very active participants in the process of our sanctification,
right,
or synonymously our maturity, our spirituality.
Right, exactly.
And you know, Jack, I have to apologize for a minute here, because at the very beginning of the program, I laughed at you because you're really hard to talk to sometimes. You just are not forthcoming. However, there is an exception to that, and that's when we start talking about the Bible spiritual issues.
Then you can't stop me.
I can't stop you, yeah. so we have a little bit of a paradox here, and that's why you're on this program, because that's what you like to talk about, and you're good at it. Okay, so I wonder if the next step, Jack, would be to define what is a mature person. What would they look like? Would that be helpful?
Yeah. And maybe the place to start is to first describe what they are not, because that's where I got confused for a long time, and I think a lot of people share my confusion.
That's good.
A mature person is not a good person, is not a fundamentally good person.
And you mean they are not morally perfect?
Right. Yeah. That it's not that their moral nature has grown and flourished and developed to the point where we could in any way describe them as perfect, or for that matter, they haven't become worthy of God, which is kind of the issue in the New Testament. Our morality is so important because that's the measure of whether or not we're worthy of God, whether we're worthy of receiving any good thing from God, any blessing, any inheritance in the kingdom of God, has to do with whether we're worthy. And as I read the New Testament, we never, ever become worthy of what God has promised us, the inheritance he's promised us.
So what you're saying is kind of a hard thing. On one hand, our worthiness is what makes us acceptable to God, except we're never going to be worthy.
Right. And therefore, it's always a matter of mercy that we receive our inheritance, that God has given us any place in eternal life, is an act of mercy, of grace on God's part, not something that we have deserved. There's a lot of theological traditions who grant that we get there by mercy and grace, but the mercy and the grace is on the front end. That is, God gave us a gift of infusing his righteousness in us, or giving us his spirit, or empowering us toward righteousness, so that we can take that gift and then make ourselves worthy with it. And if that's not their explicit theology, that's often the way it gets translated into the popular attitudes of the people in that tradition. Well, that's a really significant mistake, because part of our maturity, I think, is in recognizing, in understanding that we are not worthy and we never will be worthy in this lifetime, because worthiness is a whole lot more demanding than than we are inclined to view it.
And I'm reminded of a song, I can't remember where it comes from, but it says, "Worthy is the Lamb."
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps that's scripture too.
It comes out of Revelation, yeah.
Okay, so it's the Lamb, it's Jesus Christ who is the one who's worthy, who has taken our place, and that's, he's the one through whom we are saved, not through our own worthiness.
Exactly, yeah.
So Jack, we were talking about what is not a mature person.
Right, okay, so it's not a matter of becoming morally perfect. Well, what would that look like? What would it look like to be morally perfect? Well, if I didn't have any inclinations, any desires, any passions, any attitudes that were evil and perverse and utterly self-centered and utterly rebellious against God, if I was literally purged of all those things so that having an attitude of total submission to the will of God, having an attitude of wanting to be nothing but loving in every relationship and compassionate in every relationship.
Wouldn't it go past wanting, but actually being able
well,
to be
doing that, yeah.
fully
Absolutely.
Compassionate?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, not only wanting, but then out of that desire, just spontaneously acting out of love and obedience in everything that I did, then that would be moral perfection. And I think the Bible would say that sort of moral perfection would actually make me worthy of God. But that's not my experience. That's not what I see around me in Christian circles. And it doesn't seem to in any way be a promise or a prediction of the New Testament. It's not saying, come to Jesus, and then over time you will become morally perfect. And then that's certainly not my experience. Because however much from my heart, however much in my head I am truly, personally, existentially committed to the value of love and righteousness and obedience and so on, I nevertheless have to work against natural inclinations that are with me. And those natural inclinations, I think, are what Paul is getting at when he describes me of flesh, or he talks about my flesh in contrast to the spirit. There's something natural within me out of which arise all kinds of perverse, self-centered, prideful, arrogant, rebellious impulses within me. And those don't go away. And they make me unworthy. They are my moral imperfection. They are my brokenness. They are my corruption.
Okay, now, you're talking in superlatives, and so I want to kind of break it down a little bit if I can.
Okay.
You were saying that you're talking about evil. That's a very big word.
Okay.
Earlier you used we are utterly perverse, I think is something that you said, and therefore we're not worthy. I think a lot of people in the audience could say, well, I'm not utterly evil or utterly perverse, and so we still miss the mark of perfection if we're kind of selfish, if we're kind of impatient, if we're kind of angry, if we're missing the mark at all, it makes us unworthy of the perfection of God.
Right, okay, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I have trained myself to recognize that being kind of uncharitable is to be utterly perverse.
Yeah, but I don't think that's the language a lot of
right.
people use. I think you're right.
Right.
And for us to go around the corner and say, well, it wasn't that bad, is maybe missing the reality that I think you're trying to get at, that we really do need God and we really do need His mercy, whether we're Hitler or whether then we're a person who is just really selfish with our children and yelled at them. Both of those are not going to gain us entrance in the kingdom of God, and that's what makes it so important to be very clear to ourselves about what's really going on.
Right, yeah.
Is that why you've trained yourself that way?
Yeah, exactly, because part of the maturity, part of the mature understanding that we ultimately need to get to is to have a proper perspective on my kind of inappropriate behavior.
Right.
That my kind of inappropriate behavior is the very thing that makes me unworthy of the kingdom of God. Now, we have a tendency to compare ourselves with other people and say, on the basis of the fact that this kind of inappropriate behavior seems universal, surely God can't hold that against me. Well, the biblical perspective is surely God does hold that against me, and we've got to figure that out, and we've got to understand that, or we won't understand anything about what the gospel is really saying to us. How necessary the cross was, for example.
For me,
yeah.
I may understand that God really does not accept sinners into the kingdom, but if I have so diluted my own sin, I'm not going to understand the gospel and its relevance to my life.
Right.
I might just look at somebody else and say, well, it's obvious they're not a good person, they're a bad person, but I've, relative to them, in comparing myself to them, I'm doing so much better that surely God's going to say, well done, Christine. And then I have missed it. And in fact, I have missed having, perhaps, the opportunity for salvation because I don't see myself as needing it, and God's mercy isn't necessary for me, and I miss
right.
the boat.
Yeah, exactly. So the point is that I could be a completely and fully, I'm speaking hypothetically here, I could be a completely and fully mature believer and be what I have called utterly evil, or kind of inappropriate at times, if you prefer, but that's not going to go away in me. Even when I've arrived at my maturity, my maturity is going to coincide with a moral nature that is still corrupt, that is still quite capable of churning out all kinds of sinful, unrighteous, ungodly, inappropriate attitudes, perceptions, desires, impulses, and so on. So it's crucial to see that maturity is not transcending the brokenness of who I am. I remain morally broken as long as I live in this age. The promise of having that brokenness fixed is a promise for when I enter into the age to come.
Okay, now I think that's a really important distinction, and I think it's one that's hard to grasp. I think we need, at this point, as always, I'm looking for examples in our lives or from people in the Bible. Can you start out maybe with, in your own life, I see you as being mature in lots of areas, and yet I think you're saying, boy, I'm still broken.
Well, I find all the time, I can't think of any particular dramatic example right at the moment, but I just, as a constant of my life, I find that the impulse to have contemptuous or to be disgusted at the behavior of other people toward me that wasn't to my advantage. If somebody did something that in any way kind of slighted me or didn't give me the honor that I thought I was due or the recognition that I thought I was due or the attention that I thought I was due or something like that, there is this impulse that arises in me to feel abused, to feel what's the word I'm looking
hurt,
for?
Put out.
Yeah, to feel hurt, and I find that I have to. I don't just spontaneously get the right perspective on it. I have to stop myself and ask myself the question. Now, what's going on here, Jack? Let's stop and think about this.
Take that word and stuff it back in your mouth before it comes out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, don't. Well, usually I start thinking about it after the word is coming out of my mouth.
I know, isn't that the way we do it?
I mean, oftentimes our words reveal the condition of my heart. Probably it's my wife who hears it, not a larger public, because I can guard my mouth more carefully for my audience. But in the trusting relationship of my marriage, I'll say things that will reveal to me, what's going on in my heart. I realize you're a little bitter there, aren't you, Jack? Well, why am I bitter? Because I'm a sinner. And I think one day, when I am in glory, when I'm in the kingdom of God, those conversations will never happen. Because in the kingdom of God, it will never occur to us to be bitter, because we won't be so selfish. We won't be so self-absorbed and so much the center of our universe that it somehow logically makes sense that everybody would bow to me and meet my needs and pay attention to me and give me the honor that I think I'm due and so on. because we'll be rather preoccupied with God and his son, Jesus, getting the honor that is due him. Even as I say that, that sounds weird to us, because our whole lives are consumed by ourselves and us being the center of our own solar system. That it seems alien to us to one day have a different attitude where we're not the center of our solar system. But I think it's true. I think one day that'll be true.
I think it sounds weird to some of us, and I think other people will say, well, Jack, no, you're not a mature person in any way, because if you were, then you wouldn't feel bitter or angry or hurt by those things. You'd rise above it. And so that's just kind of evidence of your lack of maturity, because I don't have those issues. I mean, I'm not speaking for me, Christine,
right.
Speaking hypothetically, because I do, Christine, have those issues. I think we need to go on to explain the other side of this, but I think to that person I have two thoughts. One is they're not aware, perhaps, of their bitterness, their anger, their hurt, how they respond to other people, because I think we all respond, whether we cover it up or we know it directly. That's just an area that I think is universally true among us. However, there may have been an area that you would have brought up where you're weak, and somebody else could say, you know, I'm not weak in that area. In fact, I'm really strong in that area, and kind of put you down. You know, you are, you know, come on, Jack. That's such a lame thing to struggle with. Well, I think that's where we really miss the mark, and I think I've said it a lot of times on this show, but we tend to see other people's faults and neglect seeing our own. I might be strong in the particular area where you're weak, and I'll say, I can't believe that Jack has a hard time getting along with people. I don't have a hard time getting along with people. Everybody likes me. Well, but that person may be a swindler with money. But
right.
they're not looking at that part. In fact, they might have justified how they use money and, or, you know, whatever. And that tends to be a real, real weakness on our part. In fact, I was talking to somebody the other day who is so angry at Christians who proselytize, who go out and say that Jesus Christ is the only way and really want others to understand that this is really important to get this message out. And I know that some people in evangelism do it very poorly, but some people just feel it from the depths of their soul so much that they want to share Jesus, and they do it as an ongoing part of their lives. And if asked, is Jesus the only way for salvation, they would answer yes. They believe it sincerely. Well, this person I was talking to is so angry at those people for proselytizing, and yet this person will not stop talking about politics. Everywhere this person goes, she is proselytizing, in a sense, against the current political system in our country and our leaders. And every single conversation I ever have with this person, and I don't think I'm exaggerating almost at all, they are telling me how bad some leader is and sending me things and very, very pressing on it. And if I was to say, you know, I don't agree with that, they are very much down my throat. And yet in the same breath, they're saying this is the way the politics should go, and it should only go one way, and you are foolish, nuts, wrong to be abandoned and humiliated if you don't agree with this woman. Or on the other hand, they are so adamant against Christians who might say that about their faith.
Because it's dogmatic to say Jesus is the only way? Is that the...
Yeah, but do you get my comparison?
Yes.
And that's what we do. Out of our blindness, we'll see one person as doing something, and we don't see that is perhaps a mere image of something else that we do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
So getting back to our subject, you were saying that maturity is a person that's mature is not somebody who is morally perfect. The moral perfection is saved for heaven. Maturity looks different than that.
Right.
So what does it look like?
Okay.
If you were to look at this example in your life, can we carry it on? On one hand, you're broken. You're maybe angry or bitter or hurt toward a person who has wronged you, or you feel has wronged you in some way. How in that instance would maturity show itself?
Okay. Well, maturity then, and it seems to me we can talk about, it's kind of a continuum. We are more or less mature. We are more or less, we are further along toward the end of being sanctified, of being spiritual, the closer I am to being finished as made into a spiritual man, the more ready I will be to what's the word I want to use? To repudiate the impulses that are bubbling up out of my moral nature.
Repudiate is a word you often use. Can you use a synonym for it?
Reject them. Refuse to give them any validity. Refuse to give them any room in my life. And so I assess them as being wrong. I assess them as coming from that part of me that is evil. Recognizing that it's shameful. Recognizing how utterly inappropriate such attitudes are, and going the step further of making sure that I adjust my attitudes to not have my attitudes reflect those impulses that are coming from me, but rather have my attitudes reflect what I know to be true, the language that I, my conversations with other people. I make sure that I'm speaking out of what I really hardly believe is true, rather than what I want from these impulses to
you
think.
Hardly believe, or you heartily?
Heartily, yeah, I'm sorry. No, if I'm mature, I don't, it's more than hardly believe, I really firmly am committed to the truth of this, such that
it changes your behavior.
So it changes my behavior, inward behavior, I mean attitudinally, and outwardly, externally toward other people.
So what you're saying is there's kind of two things that go on. One is, and I think we can sum up what you said, is I don't justify my behavior.
Right.
I might see it. First, maybe I see it, and then I don't call it something different than it is. If it's wrong, I call it wrong, and I don't make any excuses for it. I don't give myself any space to say that's okay. It simply is not. And out of that, I kind of harness myself in, both internally and externally toward other people, and behave in a way that is as right as what I can get it.
Yes, exactly. As contrast to my immaturity. In my immaturity is a real commitment. It's just not as substantial as it one day will be. So in my immaturity, I really have come to understand that those selfish impulses are wrong, self-protective impulses are wrong. I really do believe that, but I don't believe it with the kind of firmness that allows me to easily and readily and kind of gracefully reject those impulses and rather commit to behaving and acting in a way that's right. So I may really struggle. I may struggle for minutes. I may struggle for hours. I may struggle for days and months.
Years.
And sometimes, conceivably, years on some issues in my life.
And the struggle might be that I'm trying to justify it, not see it for as bad as it is. I might want to make it look good.
Right.
And to myself and to other people, and I am not necessarily going to act in a good way toward other people, in a kind way, in a gracious way, in a loving way toward other people. I might try and get them to see me differently than I am. I might be hurtful to them in the meantime. So my struggle isn't necessarily winning out, either internally or externally, as an immature person.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it doesn't mean I'm not a believer, but this struggle is very new in me, or hasn't matured in me very much at all.
I haven't really become grounded in my beliefs enough that I've really resolved the issues. There's still a bit of a double-mindedness in me. On the one hand, I believe that what Jesus is teaching me is true. On the other hand, there's a part of me that doesn't want to believe that it's true, and I'm fighting it. I'm really resisting the truth of what I ultimately know is true, and ultimately know has to win.
Well, I might theoretically understand it's true. Like, I might theoretically understand that I'm a sinner, but for God to kind of ferret that out in my life over time really, really takes a lot of work on his part.
Yeah.
Because, you know, 10 years ago, I might have sincerely been able to justify some behavior that I could see now as really wrong, but I didn't see it then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I honestly believed I was a sinner, and I honestly was committed to wanting to pursue God, but I just didn't get it. And when people would talk to me about issues, I might just say, you know, no, that's really not how it is. I really don't see it that way. And in fact, I might be mad at you for talking to me about it, because I really don't see myself that way, and I might go to my neighbor and say, or my friend and say, can you believe Jack told me that about myself? I can't believe he'd say that. So I'm really, you know, even talking to my neighbor about that way is not a righteous way to relate, of course, but I just don't see it. And that's part of the sanctification process.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. In our immaturity, we can have just flat-out blind spots where we just don't see at all.
We can,
yeah.
And we do.
Yeah.
And
right.
I think that's the major part of our personality is for God, is that we have blind spots, and the major part of sanctification is that God's giving us eyesight in one area after another. And so, that eyesight is hard won. It's hard to see areas where we really honestly don't see, or we feel like those kind of areas just could not be who I am. They must be like this other person because they're so ugly to me. Or maybe our theology says I need to be, you know, more perfect than I am, and I can't really admit that these are truly areas in my life that are weak. I might feel like God wouldn't even accept me if I was that way. So there's a lot of obstacles to our blindness being lifted.
Yeah. And the ultimate fundamental obstacle, the big one, and that's why we harp on our sinfulness so much, is that's the logic of my sinfulness is this perception of myself that I'm not a bad person. And that's where all that resistance comes from, because if I have to look at the truth about myself, then I'm going to be staring at evidence that I am not as good as I think I am, and I really don't want to go there. I really resist that. And that blindness is ultimately self-inflicted by sinners who refuse to face into the truth about themselves. And that goes deep. I mean, that goes about as deep as anything can go.
It goes very deep. And maturity is over time being even able to say, you know, I really don't see it in myself, but I'm going to listen to that person telling me.
Exactly, right.
And, you know, I was having an argument with my son the other day in the car, and he was telling me that I was absolutely doing this one thing, and I was absolutely not doing that one thing, you know. And as I look back on it, I think we missed in terms of what we were trying to tell each other. We didn't get the content right. Neither of us did. I was trying to say one thing, and he heard something different, and vice versa. But when it came down to it, I thought, well, you know, we did miss understanding each other, and I think that's bottom line a lot of the problem. But, you know, in addition to that, I was just a real jerk in the way that I tried to work it out. So even though maybe I had been doing it pretty, my communication had been pretty right up front, and we just missed it, it's even looking at how I dealt with that and not wanting to look at, okay, so I was right in what I was saying. Well, too bad. I washed it all out in the way that I said it, in trying to force him to hear it, I was not kind at all. I was very sinful in the way that I kept pushing my way, and I was hurtful to him. So that's often what happens also. We've won the content, and so we think we're justified. But there's a whole nother level. It's the way that we were relating to each other that becomes a big issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's maturity in saying, whoops, I did it wrong there.
Right. And that's an excellent point. I mean, I really don't think that the telos is ever arrived at by anybody in this lifetime. And I mean, I don't care who they are. I don't think anyone ever really fully is committed to the truth so thoroughly that they wouldn't ever struggle at any point at all. But the New Testament does seem to distinguish between those who are mature and those who are not. So how do I reconcile those? I mean, if we never really arrive at the telos, what is this thing called maturity? I think what the apostles are saying is there really does come a point in the process of our sanctification where we reach kind of a point of no return. That is, we may have a whole lot more to learn in life, but there's no going back now, because we've got to a point where we see the truth of what Jesus is teaching us so clearly, and we are so committed to it, we are so in principle going down that road, that there's just no way we could go back. And I think that's what you're defining in a little bit, I mean a little aspect of that, is that one of the places where we go over that point of no return is when we really get comfortable with the concept that it really is okay if I'm not a good person, that I have a lot to learn. It is okay that I find myself shameful in a lot of different ways, and I don't feel this incredible need to get defensive and to not deny it and reject it, and I really can listen to other people's criticisms from now on and not have my immediate reaction being, I really don't want them to be right about this. We finally settled that issue in our life at a point where we're now in the process where we can learn a lot about ourselves that we couldn't as long as we were insistent that we stiff-arm other people's criticisms.
And it isn't that you're saying it's okay that I'm a sinner, that I should just go out and sin. Hmm. What you're saying, it's okay in the sense that I recognize that's true about myself.
Exactly. It's reality.
And I'm just looking at reality. I'm just looking at the truth more and more, and it becomes easier to do that. I don't know, Jack, but I have this kind of issue happening that when you said the point of no return, I was thinking, yeah, I get it. And it's kind of this intuitive sense of, oh, yeah, I know when I kind of crossed that threshold, but it's a little different than what you defined. It was more, I recognize in lots of the little parts of my life that I am quite a sinner. And at the same time, my maturity isn't such that I can say, and it isn't hard for me to face into that anymore. It's still quite difficult for me. There's some areas that are not as difficult as they used to be. And I think that's how our maturity goes. We kind of mature in different facets of our life, and then another one God puts right smack in the middle of our path, and we find ourselves acting in a jealous or hurtful or defensive or self-protected way, and there we go back again having to look at that because we were blind to that area. So it's kind of a point of no return, generally speaking, that we're going to keep committed to seeing those things we don't see.
Right.
That truth has become so important to us that even when it really hurts, and it hurts badly, we're eventually, at least, going to pay attention to those areas.
Right. Yeah. In my experience, there came a point where it was almost palpable. I mean, you could almost reach out and touch it, where I had this keen sense that I knew what the outcome had to be from now on out. I always had to give in and admit the truth.
Yeah. No. Yes. I think what people might have expected you to say is give in and always compromise, or give in and always say you're right, I'm wrong. But
no,
that's not
no,
what you're saying.
No,
it's admitting the truth.
Right, admitting the truth that God is trying to teach me. And whereas, you know, early in my immaturity, that was not at all a foregone conclusion. And I would fight God and really half expect that maybe I could convince him that I wasn't as bad as he was trying to say that I was. But you reach a point in your life where you realize, oh, I get it. When the New Testament says that I'm a sinner, it means that I'm a fundamentally broken human being who is a sinner, and that all that stuff is true about me, and so that I won't be and can't be surprised when I see the manifestations of it in my life from now on. So I still may struggle. I mean, to this day, there may be areas, like you say, some facet of what it means that I'm a sinner that I really may find shocking and embarrassing, and I really don't want to admit it, and I may fight God on it, but at the same time, there's this underlying sense of, but of course you're going to lose this, Jack. You know you're going to lose this, so...
You're going to win in the sense of being able to look at the truth,
yeah.
But you're going to lose in the sense of being able to have a fantasy world about yourself. Your fantasy is gone. It's crushed.
Yeah. And when you arrive at that point, then there's a kind of a security that comes from that. You realize, okay, I've arrived. I now know where this is all going to end up. I am going to become wiser. I am going to become more obedient. I am going to become more committed to the truth, and so on. I see where my life is headed now. And in time, then, my battles against the truth that God is trying to show me become less successful, less forceful. I give in earlier, I give in more quickly, And I think that's just part of maturity.
Or you're willing to soften to maybe see what the truth is more easily.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know what is really helpful in this process, Jack, is there's this other level that I hope I don't get confusing here, but I think it's so important. I was thinking, for example, in the argument that I was talking about with my son, even though I might be willing to, and I was willing to say, you know what, even though I think we were both trying to say something true and we just missed the communication, I at least really dealt poorly with the way I talked to you about it. I interrupted. I was defensive. That's wrong. But I think what's also helpful is to understand where the defensiveness came from. And that's really where we're arguing. And being able to look at what I'm really arguing about is important. What was really going on with me is I thought he was telling me I don't care about him. And it was like, wait a minute. I just went and got your snowboard waxed, and I am driving home from the chiropractor right now, and I live my life to, you know, really devoted to trying to care about you, and you're telling me in this other instance that I don't care about you? So it's this... It's, and I'm afraid of what the implications are if my son doesn't think I care about him. Mm-hmm. And what, you know, he's 18, what's that going to mean? And I just kind of got all worked up about that. And it was really helpful for me to go back and see, not to defend myself and tell him it was right for me to act that way, but it's also very helpful for me to get that kind of information so I know, okay, that's where the energy came from. That's what it's about. So when this happens again, I might be able to say, wait a minute, you know, have that work on that issue with myself. So it isn't, I'm not protecting myself from that, what's very painful kind of issue for me. Hmm. And that's a very helpful part of the process.
Right. And where the help that it gives me is that it helps me go before God to resolve the real issues for me. Namely, what am I going to do? And what I do in a situation like that typically is I have to imagine the worst case scenario. Okay, suppose that's my worst fears are true. He doesn't care about me, and whatever else, what other aspects of the fears that involve, then what?
Am I willing to accept that?
Am I willing to accept that? Yeah.
I remember sitting with a friend, a good friend, several months ago, and I was telling her about an issue in my life that was really, really hard for me, somebody else in my life, and they just kind of keep doing the same thing over and over, and she just kind of listened to it, and I was kind of blah, 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 blah about it, you know, and she just kind of listened and was kind of quiet, and finally she just kind of said, well, you know, Christine, I wonder if what it would be like for you if that never changed in him. Boom. You know, and that's the thing. That's a good friend saying that. Okay, so that's the way it is. How are you going to deal with it? And the way I need to deal with it is not try and force that person to change, but to accept the reality of that, which may be, and for, in this case, was a very sad thing for me. It, you know, I immediately welled up in tears. I was very sad. It was like a major loss for me. But what happens a lot when I'm finally able to not fight it, I soften, and I soften toward that person, and over time, what they were doing is not nearly as exaggerated, because part of it was the dance we had with each other.
Right.
That they were responding, not, they weren't just holding on to what they were doing out of their desire, their own issues, but they were responding to the hardness of me toward them in that regard. And I don't think it justifies what they did, but the reality is I had a part in this ongoing dance that was very problematic for both of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I, that's an excellent point, that a lot of things that are very, very difficult emotional issues for us, if we resolve the underlying spiritual issue of, am I going to allow God to make that the reality that I have to face? Oftentimes it just kind of takes the energy out of the issue itself. Mm-hmm. For us.
But I think what's harder, Jack, is am I going to allow God to have this issue? We don't know what the issue is.
Right. If we don't know, we can't resolve it.
If we're lost way back in the self-justification,
right.
If I was still lost way back in that with my son, I would never get to this other issue. It's hard to get to this.
Mm-hmm.
because we get stopped, we get kind of constipated with our self-justification. So we're not going through all these steps of finally understanding, oh, that's the truth, and what I'm going to do, what am I going to do with the truth? I think where we get stuck with is that person is wrong, or I'm just going to change my behavior. And although changing behavior is a valuable thing in terms of how we relate to each other, there's something deeper, and that is understanding the dynamic truth of our life. And I want to underline dynamic. It's always changing. There's always new things to learn. And as a mature person, we need to keep learning.
Yeah.
My daughter said to me the other day, why are you buying all those books, Mom? I said, because I have to really learn a lot in this area. She said, I thought you already knew everything. She said, it's so funny to see you read. And I don't know why she all of a sudden caught that I read books, because I always read books or always, you know, I'm trying to learn things. But I guess she's always kind of perceived it as, you know, my mom's already got the information. But I was really digging for information, and it was funny. But I think that's the same with our maturity, is we keep needing to dig for what's the truth in our life.
Right.
And what am I going to do with it in regard to God?
One of the ways we could define maturity then, I think, is that you're talking about becoming the process becoming constipated and stopped. The more mature a person is, the less likely it is that they're going to stop, that they're going to resist the process and stall out somewhere along the line, that the process can run its course, and what I need to learn, I learn, and it happens more readily, more quickly, more easily, more gracefully than it does in my immaturity, I think.
So, Jack, I want to go back to something that you said earlier. You said that what you do when you finally kind of figure out what the issue is, in my case it was, I was afraid that my son may not care about me, and he could leave home thinking, or think I don't care about him and leave home thinking I don't care about him. You said you think of the worst case scenario, and I think I kind of cut you off at that point and said, yeah, and kind of tumbled out. So could you kind of bring us up to date with where you were going with that?
Well, I think I finished, but if the real issue is my fear that reality be what it is, or... Actually, no, oftentimes the worst case scenario is not true, but if I'm fearing that reality is in a particular way, and that's really the issue between me and God, because I'm really strongly invested in having reality not include certain truths, certain realities, then my defensiveness, my energy, I panic, and I want to fix people, control people. I want to play God in my environment and make sure that I stave off any of those realities that I'm afraid of. So what I find I have to do is kind of ask myself the question, well, wait here. Let's assume that God is going to let this go down the way you fear it's going to go down, and this person is going to drift away, this person is going to hate you, this person is going to be alienated from you, whatever the issue is. Can you live with that, Jack? What if God does that to you? What does that mean? Has God robbed you of life itself? Is that going to be an insufferable and unbearable life? And face into the possibility of that, and then resolve with God whether God has a right to do something that traumatic in my life. And the answer, of course, I already know. Yes, he has the right. And if he did that, would he be evil or would he be good? Well, actually, he'd be good, because he would be doing it only because he has my best interest in mind. He would never allow that apart from his desire to teach me and to make me grow and be more fit for his kingdom one day. And when I get that larger perspective, then I'm in a position where I don't need to fear any longer. I can accept from God whatever it is he has in store for me.
You're not fearing in the sense that you're wondering if God is for you.
Right.
But it may be, maybe if Jody decided to leave you, and it's a very real, difficult thing, it could be that you're, in accepting what what's in front of you, it's living with the pain of having been divorced,
mm-hmm.
of having your family split, of having loneliness all the time. So it isn't just this one stop, you know, I figured it out and it's done, but it could be I figured it out, okay, that's the reality of what happened. Is it all right for God to take away my wife? I will let that be. But it's painful for me.
Yes. And that's part of what I have to resolve is, God, am I willing to go through the pain of what you might do to me?
And I might have to do that every day of my life.
Yeah.
For the rest of my life.
Yeah, that will be revisited. We can kind of settle once and for all the direction that I'm committed to going, but as the pain arises, I need to revisit that issue over and over and over again, reminding myself of what direction I decided I want to go in my life.
At the end of this century, the big questions about reality and being human rise with unexpected power. We ask, ever more agonizingly, what does it mean to be human? How do human beings fit into this vast cosmos? Where to from here? In his News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality, Mackenzie Study Center member Wes Hurd shows how our present-day culture answers these questions in radically non-biblical ways. He shows how the prevalent postmodern view of life is fed to us through television, popular music, and education. However, he also states that although postmodernism has many negative aspects, it may present opportunities for biblical Christians to dialogue more openly with people who need real answers to some big questions. Call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Postmodernism, A New Model of Reality.
Christine, for a number of months now, we've been trying to let our listeners know where we stand financially and asking them to contribute as they can. We've got lots of feedback that the program has been helpful to people in a number of different ways. But do you know how we stand financially right now?
The small contributions have kind of trickled in. And in terms of larger contributions, I think we've gotten two. We actually got two $8,000 contributions. And the second $8,000 contribution, the people ask that we match the funds. So they will give up to $8,000 dependent on how much is given up to that amount. So it's a possible $16,000 contribution, which is pretty significant. And it's very encouraging.
So any of the listeners out there who are willing to make a contribution to match the funds, they could support us to the tune of another $8,000 then.
Right.
Great.
Which is pretty exciting.
Yeah.
So thank you for contributing, and we again encourage you to consider contributing if this program has been beneficial to you.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff in their ministry through their classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.